nice to be here. I love your walls.
Hello and welcome to the Scandal Podcast, your weekly look at the world of film news, Irish and international. I'm Darren Mooney, and joining me are...
Jay
and Roman.
And this week it's a special podcast, not just because it's a guerrilla-style let's get in and get out as quickly as possible, but because it's coming at you live from the Virgin Media Dublin International Film Festival.
We are literally in the festival.
Right now, as you speak and as you are listening. Yes, myself and Jay are just back from Poppy Chulo.
Yeah, the new John Butler film.
Yes.
Which was the gala premiere for to open the festival.
Yeah. A screening twice, actually. I believe there's a second screening taking place as we're recording this now.
That sounds about right.
So, what did we make of it, Jay? Sorry, I realise we are leaving out Ronan.
Yeah, it's okay. I didn't see it, but it's okay. I liked it. I think you mentioned, we were chatting about it on the way up, and Darren mentioned that it's kind of better in the first half, and I'd agree with that. I think it's a strong kind of opening half of the film. It suffers a little bit by kind of structural thing that it does in the second half.
Yeah. Just by way of introduction, it is basically, at its simplest level, it is a buddy movie, an opposite attracts movie about a relatively well-to-do weatherman in Los Angeles. Who, through circumstances, ends up in a situation where he is isolated, alone, unable to talk to somebody, and ends up taking on a Mexican worker.
Kind of work labor.
Yeah. Work labor to help paint his deck.
Ostensibly to do that.
Ostensibly. And inevitably, the relationship kind of develops and goes in directions that I don't think either of them quite anticipated when the relationship began. Yeah, and basically develops from there. The first half, you're right, I thought the first half was stronger because it focuses on that odd couple dynamic. Yeah. And then it kind of... I think this was a somewhat loaded dynamic, to be honest. Like, I mean, the basic premise of it is it's something you have to do very carefully.
Yeah, it's tricky, but I think for the most part it gets away with it.
Yeah.
I think it's careful enough. I think it's very aware of what it's doing. So I kind of, because I like the central kind of friendship so much, I kind of forgive it a little bit. But I do think there's a certain point in the second half where it kind of does something that doesn't quite
land.
Yeah, and it doesn't kind of, the film drops a little because of it. But it kind of comes good just about at the end, and I quite liked it. I think it's good. I think it's certainly worth seeing. And yeah, I enjoyed it.
No, I liked it a lot too. I was probably a bit more wary of those things than I think you were. In that, like, it's a
you're
film
saying I'm culturally ignorant.
No, no, that's not what
you're
saying. I'm just saying
that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
From the podcast pro Green Book panelists.
Indeed, yeah.
No. All joking aside, it does, like, I mean, it's very clearly aware of the potential issues in a film like this, and it's very clearly engaged with them. There's a lot of kind of, you know, bubbling beneath the surface. There's a lot of engagement with the idea that for Ernesto, that the helper, the situation is very different than it is for the weatherman with whom he's sort of become embroiled. And the film sort of that simmering away in the background. It just, for me, I was kind of, there was a push and pull there that I'm not sure it got entirely right. I think it got it very right while they were on screen together.
Yeah.
Because the chemistry between the two is strong enough that you don't really, you aren't thinking, well, what are the implications?
I don't need to question it because they're good together.
And it's clever enough to do that. Anyway, so that was a strong start to the festival. But actually, before we jump into what we watched this week, Ronan has done some really great work here. I'm looking at it. There's a piece of paper, which is normally Jay's provision.
And it's color coded.
And it's
There's color coordination. There are line breaks. There are little highlighted things that say I only have 18 minutes to eat between films.
This is your festival schedule. So
this is my festival
schedule. Can you talk us through, like, very, very briefly, like the highlights, the lowlights, and some of the color coding, which is quite striking from this angle.
Some of the color coding is trying to coordinate people that I may be seeing films with and all sorts of things. I'm trying to get a lot done here visually.
So I'm on it. Is that what you're saying?
You are, absolutely.
Excellent.
It's just a big J printed across it. No, it's very important to me to be able to figure out how long I have to get places, whether I have stuff to eat.
These are important things.
And most importantly, pack in as many films as humanly possible, despite the fact that I've just missed the opening. But, you know, we will try to turn that around.
But we're hoping to get this out later in the week. But so if people are looking for something in, say, the second week, like, what's jumping out at you? What are you most excited about in the second week of the festival?
There's a lot of highlights, a lot of things I'm looking forward to. There is a four-hour Chinese film called An Elephant Sitting Still on the final day, which I'm very much looking forward to because, you know, who doesn't want to finish up a 12-day film marathon with 4 hours of Chinese cinema?
I was talking to the programmer of Fantastic Flicks, who described it as one of those, every year at the festival there's one that you feel that you were proud that you watched. It's like an accomplishment.
You
feel like you've accomplished something by attending it, and this seems to be very much positioned as the end leg of that particular marathon.
There's an interesting film on the 1st of March, which I believe is a Friday, called Of Fathers and Sons, which is kind of quite topical with what's going on in the news at the moment. It's about people caught up in everything going on with the Islamic State.
I'm at that as well, I think.
Yeah. Looks that looks like it could be really interesting. Out of Blue on the 26th. I'm really, really looking forward to the new
Patricia Clarkson.
Kyle Morley is absolutely tremendous director. He's done great work over the last couple of years, so I'm really excited for this.
I had to drop out of that one today, unfortunately. I was really excited about it, but something came up that clashed.
I will.
Out of the blue.
Hey. Right before it, that same day, I'm seeing What Time Is Death, the new Paul Dwan film, and I'm a very, very big fan. His film, it's going to get a cinema release this year, I think, last film, Where You Live Shine.
Oh, the one from last year. If You Missed It Due to the Snow.
It showed at last year's festival, and the screening went ahead. About four people made it. I trudged through the snow for it, and it was worth it.
I saw it as well. It's a really good.
Terrific film. So really looking forward to this new one. And there, you know, there's lots of good stuff. I'm looking forward to Happy as Lazaro, especially since
Jay's cherry-picked
it for me.
And my favourite film this year so far.
We should go into business with this. You should have Jay cherry-pick a number of films for the festival.
I'll pick all your films.
I think this would be a great fundraising thing.
I'm up for that.
A customised, fully personal sort of...
And if you don't like it, I'll complain bitterly about it on air for an extra fee.
Perfect.
Great.
All right then, so let's jump into the usual stuff, and we're going to try and keep it relatively brief this week, so I may end up buzzing or cutting off
good,
people.
Oh, good luck.
So, I know. So what have we watched since last we talked, Jay and Ronan? Jay.
I'll kick off. I rewatched, because I haven't watched it in about 20 years, Point Break, the Catch a Bigger film with Keanu and Patrick Swayze. And I've always liked this. I like Early Bigelow more than kind of Ladder Bigelow to a certain
Prestige
degree.
Black Label Bigelow.
Yeah, and I think I'll watch this because I remember it's always considered a kind of campy kind of classic and stuff like that. You know, it's fantastic. Like it's really good. It's great. Like there's so many Keanu gifable moments here, like which you've seen so many times as well. Like
Shouted into the air while firing your gun randomly? Yeah, yeah.
It's so much great handheld camera work. Like really great handheld camera work by Bighorn's team. So much energy in it. It's iconic. There's two or three absolutely astonishingly put together scenes. One's a foot chase across the city, which is glorious. And another one is the first skydive, which is remarkably put together. And just they're really unexpectedly well. Like, you know, the way we watch action films and stuff like that, we complain about some of the scenes to be a bit pedestrian in terms of put together a lot. I find that modern blockbusters tend to be a bit more pedestrian in this kind of way.
Yeah.
This is inventive, it's smart, it's kind of geographically makes sense. All these things that should be taken for granted to some degree, but aren't necessarily always the case. It's really good. And Keanu is fantastic and Swayze. It's like it's a love story between the both of them. Like that's essentially the film.
It's not even like Top Gun level.
No, it's not. No.
Top Gun has like naked volleyball. Like.
Yeah. No, but it's great. It's a love story for the ages. It's Apollo and Rocky splashing about in the sea for 2 hours. That's okay. That's great.
This is the movie where, like, you know, again, you talk about gifted moments, so I don't think it counts as a spoiler, but where you have the moment of betrayal between the two men, where like he has the gun and he can't do it, so he fires his clip randomly into the air while shouting in emotional agony.
It's got everything.
It's opera.
I always enjoyed it, but so I didn't know how well a rewatch would go because it's a long time. But it's much better, much more sophisticated than I thought.
Well surfed by time?
It has indeed. Stop it, Aaron. We'll move on. I watched Polytechnic, which is the Denis Villeneuve film, which
you being such a fan and all.
Yeah, well, I like short. this is less than a bar that long.
Well, this is the film that's generally considered to have kicked off the second stage of his career.
Yeah, and it's the one that's kind of really liked by a lot of your art house hipster film Twitter people.
So brace yourselves.
I know, I like that. It's not bad. It's really, really well shot. And
almost as if he's a very good craftsman.
I'm not going to say anything, but it's really well put together. It's a true story about a shooting in a Canadian school. And it's very clear, and Villeneuve, in fairness, calls out straight away and pretty early that this is a misogynistic killing. This is a guy who hates feminists and goes in school and deliberately separates girls and boys and shoots the women.
Jesus.
This is very clear and very concise, and he's straight in with it. And I think this plays better now than it did in 2009, a decade ago.
I'm wary of saying it's aged well, but it's aged in a way that feels relevant,
it certainly has. It's really well shot. It's completely unnerving, particularly for the first 25-30 minutes. You know what's coming, but how it kind of sustains a certain feel of people going about their day. Shot in black and white, really, really looks great. But there's a couple of things that he does towards the end, kind of second hand, that they're a little heavy handed, and the narrative choice a little kind of, I don't know, it doesn't quite work. Like, what he's going for is admirable, and what he's showing is admirable, but he kind of plays the time a little bit in a way that I could see exactly why it probably lands for some people. It doesn't quite work for me.
I haven't seen this one. I've seen Incendies, and Incendies has a very, from what you're describing, a very similar element that it's like, well, if you're on the level of the film, that moment really landed for you, and if you're not, you're like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it just, it like, it's not that to that level. No, I know, yeah. I know people that have, who, like, this, they have Pontiac's first rate, and Incendies is first rate. So I haven't got to Incendies yet. It's probably the last one I'll see of his.
You have no burning desire to see it?
No, I do not.
I look forward to a heated debate.
Stop. Just stop.
Don't get into a flame war with the fans.
You're just eating up my minutes here.
Sorry.
So I'm going to take an extra 30 seconds. And last one I'll mention is, because Ronan insisted upon it, I watched Jodorowsky's Dune.
Ah, yes. Excellent.
And
speaking of Villeneuve.
Indeed, yeah. That's on my link. God, I'm good, aren't I? Even when he doesn't know it. I don't know anything about Dune, really, bar the generic kind of cultural kind of reference to it here. I've never read the book. I've never seen the Lynch film.
If you work with that rhythm, Jay,
Villeneuve's going to make a 12-hour film about it, or cut into seven parts, or whatever the hell he's
going
to do.
Really?
It's going to be a two-parter, and each of the two parts will probably be about 2.5 hours.
Two-part film.
Yeah. The only issue is that they're filming the first part separately, so
we'll see about that.
I wouldn't bank on that second part.
Yeah.
This documentary is fascinating because this is this remarkable point of, you know, where somebody's absolutely absurdly brilliant imagination meets reality in terms of the film business and the things that can ensue, but also it's a little heartbreaking because what comes together in terms of the artists are involved and stuff like that is kind of has that kind of beautiful timing of the right people together at the right time that you feel should be made. Like, because these are top people. I mean,
Geiger and
Dan O'Bannon and stuff went on to Alien and stuff like that. And I think Winding Refn mentions the whole thing about that feels very influential, even though it was never made. Which I quite liked. A certain arsehole film critic turns up in it, which I won't mention his name, but we all know his name.
Again, he was everywhere at the time.
He was everywhere at the time. It starts with an F. You can find him yourself.
Only knows who you're talking
about. Yes, indeed. But this is really great. And then I said to you earlier, Darren, in the days where David Ayer and Max Landis can get $100 million to make Bright for Netflix, it seems absolutely bizarre to me that Netflix will say, "There's Jodorowsky, there's $100 million, make whatever the hell you want, and we'll watch it," because we're just sticking content anyway. So why not give it to somebody that has talent and imagination?
Because he's still trying to cast Orson Welles.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. I absolutely wouldn't doubt it. What a cast.
Wells.
Dali.
Yeah.
Oh my,
it's extraordinary.
God, I wanted to see it so badly. Yeah, book, I would buy that book as a coffee table.
Absolutely.
Like, Jesus,
it's gorgeous. What I absolutely adore about this is just the boundless energy of Jodorowsky. The kind of
he's got so much to say, and he's so enthusiastic.
I think the thing that hinges this whole film together is the sadness of this film never having been made. But he's not a sad person.
No.
He is just, he's delighted that he got to conceive of it in his head and that he gets to think about it.
Pull the crack team together.
Yeah. And reliving it, he's just so excited.
Because it's
going to
change
it.
Mankind. This is not just a film. Yeah. It's remarkable stuff like
that. And he's able to say things like that and obviously be incredibly up himself, but get away with it.
Yeah, because he does have a certain twinkle in the eye. That's like, now I know I'm full of shit and I'm a salesman. But that's okay, because this is what we need to get these things together. Like, it's great. I really liked it. I really, really liked it.
One thing that I absolutely love about it is this whole idea that this was going to be an amazing thing and we were close to making it, but they weren't at any point. No. They wrote a treatment and everyone went, no.
But it didn't seem like that much money. Like, it's like in relative terms, like, you know.
Well, I mean, like, well, this was what year was this?
75, I think, wasn't it?
Okay, so like multiply it by what?
But I think they had money. They were looking for extra money. They had some money, so they needed kind of fill up money. It just seemed... I know. Anyway,
I just wish they had.
Filming. So do I. I would have loved to have seen this. And the clips I saw, the Lynch version in this, my God, it looks appalling. Absolutely
it's
appalling.
Fascinating.
That's two different things, Darren.
It's like it's
that's two different things. It's fascinating. But Jodorowsky says he eventually got dragged to the cinema seat. It's like, and they started laughing because it's so
it
bad.
Was shit.
It's fascinating. It's not a good film,
no,
but
it's not.
Deeply 30 seconds
of footage is enough to convince me that it's not a good film.
But again, like, you're asking David Lynch to make like a Star Wars film, basically. And like,
I'm sure Lucas did that.
I mean, the two of them are basically comparable, right?
But anyway, that was my week.
All right, Ronan.
I don't mean to alarm you, but I may have had the best week of watching films, certainly on this podcast, possibly ever.
Good Jesus.
Yes, whoa. I'm alarmed. I've had an extraordinary
And week. We only have 5 minutes of your Jodorowsky-esque enthusiasm.
If I'd have known that, I'd have cut 2 minutes off mine.
Not at all. Kicked off a brief encounter at the NCH. My fifth time seeing you. It's second glorious. Time with live score. It's just fantastic. It doesn't set a foot wrong and just trampling all over my heart. It is joyously funny and absolutely heartbreaking. I love it. I love it. I love it. Moved on to new things after that, Mikey and Nikki, because Jay has been badgering me about Elaine May for years, and thank you.
It's so good, isn't
this
it?
This is incredible.
Yes.
It's very much in that vein of 70s thrillers, you know, the like of Serpico and all that new Hollywood stuff that people talk about, you know, with bated breath, about Scorsese and
right
Coppola. And this is as good. This is better than
better
most
than a lot of them.
Yeah. No, I absolutely adored this. I was kind of left staggered by the end going, holy shit, what have I watched?
It's this incredible
sort of scalpel, you know, taking a scalpel to masculinity and sort of the patheticness of it, but the danger that, you know, the way men behave is absolutely laughable, but also so threatening to so many people. Completely undercuts them, but makes them sympathetic. It's such a nuanced character piece.
It's such a tricky thing to do.
And it's the kind of thing I think sometimes that can only be made from the outside. Only a woman could have made a film like this. It's absolutely tremendous. The dialogue is so funny. It's so dark visually and thematically. I cannot wait to watch more of her stuff.
All of them are worth watching. Everything is worth watching.
And reading the stories.
And apart masterpiece.
Reading the stories about her letting the film roll for hours, even after people had gone off the stage. And like, you think that is a mad approach. But look at what it got her. Yeah. This is absolutely phenomenal. Continue my Jacques Tati run through with Parade, his last film, which is bonkers. It's a circus shot for Swedish TV. Everyone in the audience looks like they're an ABBA. And then there are bits on a soundstage which are shot in a completely different camera. It doesn't fit together at all, but it's mad. It's a circus. It's great fun. Very weird. Very weird. Kind of liked it a lot, but yeah, a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Then where do we go now? The second film from Nadine Labaki, whose Capernaum is out this week.
That's the one I've been talking about, but I do want to see.
Yeah, this is, it's not as good as Caramel, her previous film, which I was talking about a couple of weeks ago. It is set in the aftermath of the Lebanese Civil War in the middle late 70s. It's a little village that's essentially cut off from the world with people of various different religions living together. And as tensions heat up between them, the women of the village essentially in this sort of slapstick caper try to hide all media coverage from the men so that they don't realize that tensions are boiling up and they can preserve the sort of peace in their village.
Yeah.
Very, very good comedy coming out of this, but also some high dramatics, which sometimes veer into, you know, over dramatics. Labaki also acts here, and she gives herself one major scene where she gets to perform, you know, very well, but it's kind of overdoing it at the same time. It's the comedy where she really succeeds here. But this is very good second film, and it's taken her a long time to get Capernaum out here, so I'm really looking forward to see that. What else do we have? Fellini's first film, The White Sheik. He had previously co-directed something. Not very good. It's a silly Italian comedy from the 50s. There's a lot of kind of gentle humour about Catholicism and marriage and sex. But it's very much before he became Fellini, I guess.
I haven't seen much of Fellini. It's a bit of a hole in my kind of filmography. But it's kind of one of those things that I wish I'd watched when I was younger. Because I think I'll approach it very differently now in that kind of the great white filmmaker type.
They're
not great. It's just it's a different kind of thing. But I think I've only seen one of his.
There is one interesting part here where is it Giulietta Messina, who was his wife, the actress? She turns up for a moment in a kind of highlight scene playing a prostitute called Kabiria, and he loved the scene so much that he structured a film around her, Knights of Kabiria, which I'm going to watch this week. Right. Well, actually, no, festival, probably a couple of weeks' time.
Let's hope that is happening, yes.
Yeah. Last night rewatched Do the Right Thing for the first time in a long time.
Pretty great.
Holy shit, it's great.
Ferocious.
Only seen it once before and liked it a lot then, but I don't think I fully appreciated the kind of political circumstances around it. I may have been, you know, 18 last time I saw it. It's immense. It's really, really great. And it's one of those films that so successfully manages its atmosphere in terms of the sort of the political atmosphere, but the physical atmosphere that I don't think you can watch it and not sweat.
Yeah.
It feels hot constantly. Lee has that sort of manic energy in his camera work where he's thrusting it into people's faces. It's extremely first person. You can't not engage with it, I think.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's a phenomenal film.
It's absolutely remarkable. Now, rewatching in the context of Black Klansman, I think he has lost none of his vitality whatsoever. And there's a certain anger in Black Klansman that why haven't you been listening? Nothing has changed here. It's like reading James Baldwin in the modern age. You know, we've known about these problems for a long time. How have we still got to the point where they've got worse? It's remarkable.
I do think that the Black Klansman is, I don't want to use the word mellow because there's obviously a lot of righteous anger
sure.
but it's a lot less confrontational, I think, than Do the Right Thing.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't mean that in like a he's lost his edge sort of way. He's very consciously, I think, trying to broaden the tent. It's much more inclusive.
I wonder if he'd get budget for the type of film Do the Right
That's
Thing
true,
is.
Yeah.
I think there
yeah.
might be an element to it as well.
I think in a way, Black Klansman, what it's doing as well is trying to be more sort of openly enjoyable, and then in the end it kind of gets Hitchy. That confrontational thing that, you know, it's gathered a very white crowd at that point, and it's able to sort of slam this thing in their face. But no, I'd agree with you there. Do the Right Thing is much more aggressive. Yeah. And see that, you know, the way it closes with the Martin Luther King and the Malcolm X thing kind of gets to the question of how do things erupt in violence? Well, because we let them, because we let people have no other solutions. And finally, very quickly, I watched Jonas Mackus's As I Was Moving Ahead. Occasionally I Saw Brief Glimpses of Beauty, which is a long title and a much longer film. Comes in at 288 minutes,
wow.
or 3.6 Fardas, if you're keeping count. Max, of course, died last month, and I figured I would pay tribute while this was still on Mubi, because I haven't watched a very long film in a long time, because, you know, they take up quite such a lot of time.
Did you feel like an elephant sitting still?
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, I was also trying to train myself for an elephant sitting still.
It's like Rocky. It's a much less exciting montage, though, but it's...
despite the insane length here, it actually kind of whizzes by. It's structured in 12 chapters, each of which is almost exactly 24 minutes long. It's Max's narration over old 16mm footage of his kids growing up in the 70s and very early 80s, spans about 13 years. And it's really incredible. It's it constantly has, well, not constantly, you know, a couple of times during the film, it has these title cards that flash up saying, nothing happens in this film. And this is a political film. And there's a real tongue-in-cheek aspect of that. His narration is extremely funny. He mostly comes on screen laughing.
Yeah.
Because he's literally sitting in an editing room splicing these things together. All his family he kind of talks about are either dead or he doesn't see very often. There's a sort of undercurrent of sadness there. But he's a very jubilant person. And it becomes this question of what meaning is there in life? Well, it's whatever we give it. It's whatever we can find in our memories. It has the pace of memory. It's extremely quick cuts. For the entirety of it, the almost 5 hours, you know, there is no shot that's longer than 3 seconds.
Would you find, I'd find that exhausting, maybe?
It is a little bit. I paused a few times, you know, at different chapter ends, went, you know, had a cup of tea, walk around or whatever, but it's really, really moving.
In the,
it gets at the idea that life has whatever meaning we choose to confer on it. And it's beautifully edited, and I think the sense of humor it has throughout really ties it all together. Hugely recommended if you can spare 5 hours.
All right. So very quickly, myself, rewatched a couple of rewatches at the weekend. The Favourite was the Mooney Family Movie Night on Friday night. Went down surprisingly well, actually, which was not what any of them were expected, but surprisingly funny.
It's reaching a very wide audience.
That's it, exactly. And I mean, I think we had Grace on a couple of weeks ago was saying, like, one of her friends was like, well, that was a bit odd, but would I like the director's other films? And you're like, if you thought that was a bit odd.
It is a broader film.
It is a much broader film, and I think it works very well in that respect. Mm. Watching it with other people, it's amazing how funny it is as well. I actually really liked it. Played very, very well. Also, rewatched Predator, which was, fantastic, as it tends to be, having rewatched it before. What really struck me this time is how much of a Vietnam movie it is in many respects, to the point where it's one of those movies in the 80s, like, for example, Rambo, like, for example, Die Hard, where it plays as this sort of weird, heroic reconstruction of the Viet Cong fantasy, where you have the American protagonist who gets to effectively cast himself as an insurgent who's opposing this stronger force. In both Predator and in Die Hard, it's quite literally an invasive force. It's a bunch of foreign terrorists or a big game hunter from outer space. And it's kind of fascinating how you have that sort of like Vietnam trauma playing through it. And again, I'd argue that, you know, these days you have superhero movies doing something similar with 9/11, where, for example, you have the Avengers has Iron Man going on a suicide mission over the skies of New York City as a replaying that particular formative trauma. The Defenders, which hinges on the idea of the superheroes blowing up a skyscraper to save the island of Manhattan, to pick another example. And it's kind of interesting how those sort of traumas replay themselves and how narratives attempt to sort of reclaim them in a certain respect sort of after that time. Saturday Night Mooney Family Movie Night was Bad Times at the El Royale, which was great fun.
Did you do two family movie nights?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Your poor family, they're not great choices.
Lockdown gangbusters, thank you very much. When I was away, they watched Lost City of Zed, and I did not hear the end of that.
I liked Lost City.
Yeah, that did not go well down.
Me and the Moonies would not get
on. The Moonies are a very different...
Well,
the Mooney Christmas movie is always either the Nolan film, or last year it was Mission Impossible Fallout, and that plays to a packed house.
God help them.
The Nolan films.
The Nolan films.
Well, you have watched the Nolans and loved them.
I did try. Like,
they're afraid to tell them you don't like Nolans, aren't they?
My biggest disappointment as like programmer of like the Mooney Family Christmas movie is when I played Inside Out and it got booed, basically.
What?
Yeah.
No. You're that's a monster.
It's a tough room. It takes a lot to work them. But
no,
you know,
if you don't like Inside Out, that's wrong. Tell them they must stop.
Anyway, but yeah, Bad Times at the RL went down very well. Again, it's...
All 6 hours of it?
I absolutely love the fact that it takes its time doing what it does.
It does.
Like, there's long, uninterrupted takes of Sylvia Olivero
of me making
singing.
Coffee.
Of Cynthia Olivero, like, singing these songs from beginning to end without any real cut in there. Because it can. There's a wonderful moment where you have a pan around her singing. And the idea is to get to the shot of Jeff Bridges, sort of like who's doing something in the corner of the room. And the way the camera's positioned, you can move either 90 degrees or 270 degrees to get there. The camera chooses to move 270 degrees in slow motion to get there as well. And I kind of like that.
I wouldn't like this.
Don't care for this. Yeah, and again, it's that sort of plays in that aspect of like 2018, 2019 as replaying the trauma of 1968 from America's perspective. Yeah, yeah. This idea of a society on the verge of collapse where everything that everybody assumed they knew to be true is no longer true. And Chris Hemsworth is shirtless for a lot of it. So you win some.
Maybe I would like this.
No, you wouldn't. Just look up the pictures.
And then finally, triple whammy to get ready for. I mean, we all went into training for the Dublin Film Festival.
Indeed.
I dragged out some of my old screeners from awards season so I could rewatch them because technically the Oscars hasn't happened yet. So I'm not breaking the sort of piracy constraint. Oh, we're going to be talking about that later. But yeah, so I rewatched The Sisters Brothers, Vox Luck, and Ben Is Back. Ben Is Back is Keanu as a prestige picture.
What's Keanu? Sorry.
Keanu's the movie, Key and Peele movie, where they kidnap the cat.
Never even heard of this.
It's not great.
No, it has a really good. I've never heard of it.
No, it's not. It's not. It has a really good role for Anna Faris playing herself. Okay. But like the rest of the movie is hackneyed, overplayed, and not particularly funny.
And this is that.
This is that, but as a prestige picture.
Oh, is this the Lucas Hedges A24 Owned You film?
Yeah, this is the one where written and directed by his father, in which it's Lucas Hedges does Beautiful Boy, so it's less Sundance. It's less Sundance and more like beloved family pet is kidnapped. So suburban mother and drug addict son venture into a world of darkness.
What is going on with drug addict kids movies? Like, what are we back in Lifetime? What the hell's going on?
Well, I mean, there is like an opioid crisis happening.
Yeah, I know. But they could do with, rich white people having an opioid problem. It's not really the story, though, is it? Like, I mean, it's not.
But Jay, it's hard on the whites.
It is.
And then finally, a bunch of sneak peeks for stuff that's coming to Netflix in the coming week, so I won't talk about them too much. Isn't It Romantic, which opened in the States last week, which is... really odd. It pitches itself as like a cabin in the woods, but with romantic comedies, where a woman who hates romantic comedies gets banged on the head and finds herself in a romantic comedy. But instead, its big conclusive point is, hey, maybe people like romantic comedies, which feels somewhat redundant a year after the success of Set It Up to All the Boys I've Ever Loved and Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it feels it misses the boat on that one. And The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, which is Chiwetel Ejiofor's directorial debut based on a true story, a BBC and BFI film that's coming straight
to Netflix.
Which is... interesting. It's dumped is a very strong word. It's
accurate though,
it's
isn't it?
It's perfectly competent. No, it's
starring.
It's
that's a very strong term.
It's no, but it is. It's grand. It's a charming story. It's told relatively well. It's very earnest and well meaning, perhaps a little bit too much so. But anyway, let's talk about the week in film news. So I'm afraid we won't have time to do these the justice that we need to, but Bruno Ganz passed away.
Yes.
He did. Kind of youngish, 77.
Yeah. Which I was astounded by, because that means he was, 64 when he played Hitler in Downfall? No, I know that's the go-to role. I know, obviously, he had a rich and very creative American friend and obviously, like, Wings of Desire and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was kind of, like, that was the big takeaway. For me, that was the big sort of media shock.
64, yeah. It does feel very, very long ago, doesn't it, in a way? Because it's had this extraordinary online life. It's become... possibly the most meme performance of all time.
I would say so.
Almost certainly. And it's incredible. I think the reason that it's worked so well is that it's this perfect fusion of sort of patheticness and genuine fury.
Yeah.
Terrifying, but it's laughable.
Which is one of the films pitching, which is great.
Yeah. It's an absolutely terrific performance. He's he really was a great actor.
Yeah.
And he was the bearer of the Iflan ring. You hear about this?
No.
Bearer of what?
The bearer of the Iflan ring. Sounds like a Lord of the Rings style thing.
It does.
It is an award bestowed to the greatest actor in the German theater tradition and passed down on his death to someone of his choosing.
Are there like 30 of them stranded in a room and the winner gets the ring?
And who did he choose? Do we know?
It hasn't been announced yet. It will have been in his will, because within 3 months of receipt, you must choose a person.
Wait, oh, you choose? So it's passed like from successor to successor?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's extraordinary. It goes back 150 years.
What happens if the person you choose dies before you do?
Then you choose somebody else.
I imagine
there's all sorts of things like that. If you don't choose somebody, or if there is some sort of things that, like that, there is an Austrian delegation who decides. But yeah, it's absolutely... And it was extremely controversial when he got it. I believe in the 80s, I think he was given it by... I can't say I've heard of his predecessor. They're mostly theater actors. But it was controversial because he's Swiss. Or he was Swiss, rather. And they didn't like that very much. But yeah, I think it's a mark of his respect across the German-speaking world very much.
The English-speaking world as well.
You know, he became known in Hollywood productions very often.
Yeah. The last thing I saw him in was Sally Potter's The Party.
He was in that.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. It's not a particularly great film. He gets good performance in it. There's some good performance in it. And I know he's in the House of Jack build, but I'm not going to bother.
Yeah,
but he did turn up in some dreadful Europe.
Oh yeah, he's like Night Train to Lisbon counselor as well.
And he always had this sort of amazing.
Was he one of the Bond bad guys along with Michael Nyquist, if I remember correctly?
Was he?
Sorry, not Bond. Mission Impossible. Wasn't he one of them along with Michael Nyquist? Or am I getting them mixed up?
I don't know. I thought Nyquist. But also, just to point out, he's also in the upcoming Terrence Malick film.
Relevant. Oh, really?
World War II set one.
Okay, I'm
is
watching
there
that
somebody
now.
Else in that one as well, is there?
Well,
I mean, there's obviously somebody else.
Yes,
that, but I mean, I think there may be another posthumous.
Is Michael Nyquist as well?
Yes, Michael. Yeah. Okay.
Both of them, which shows you how, you know, Ting does his films, that, you know.
How long it takes. Well.
But apparently it's going to be a can.
All right. And also, because we didn't mark it last week because we were in sort of such a hurry and everything was a bit rushed, Albert Finney passed away over a week ago, which is also a massive loss.
It's quite upsetting, isn't it?
Yeah.
A bigger loss for me in terms of than Gantz to some degree, because I would have grown up watching Finney and that kind of generation of UK actors, the kind of working class generation, I could still call it. In the kind of stuff like Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, Long Distance Runner, those kind of films that would have been made in the 60s. Fabulous actor. He could kind of slot in anywhere, leading man, character actor, do a bit of everything. I'd be a huge Finney fan. And then the kind of age where a lot of the actors seem to be coming from, the upper classes in the UK now.
And properly trained.
Private schools. You're seeing the last of the kind of that generation passing, which is very dreadfully sad.
Yeah. My abiding story about Finney, or one of the moments that endured me to Finney outside of his performances, is the story about Aaron Brockovich, where he was considered to be the favourite for the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. All he had to do was literally come over to Hollywood and do some glad handing. His response to the publicist was, fuck off. He didn't win the Oscar.
He didn't seem like he had any time for that kind of carry-on. The first thing that came to my mind was Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, because it was one of the early films that had like an enormous impact on me, and his performance is a huge part of that, the sort of terrible anger he has at the idea of his sons betraying him. And it was all his presence that stood out for me. Big loss.
All right, very, very quickly moving through the rest of the news. The Indian cinema legend Amir Khan will be the special guest at the 2019 Belfast Film Festival in April.
Okay.
Yeah, very excited about that. At least I am personally. No, Khan is great. He's one of the great actors working today. Huge impact in Indian cinema, including films like, say, Three Idiots, PK, Lagan from 2001, which is fantastic. If you are looking to try one of the Amir Khan movies, Lagan is probably the one to go for. It has that sort of very MGM studio style film quality to it, with the widescreen shooting, the big musical numbers, and the use of colour as well. It's quite striking. He'll be there. He'll be screening Dangal, which is the movie that he produced with Disney in 2016, which is the highest grossing film at the Indian box office of all time. It is the story of a...
That's gotta be a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. I'm not sure we're talking like Wandering Earth money, which, by the way, Wandering Earth, which is the movie blockbuster in China, only the second movie to earn more than $800 million. At a single like country's box office.
Good grief.
The other one being The Force Awakens. Force Awakens in the States. Amir Khan will be at the Belfast Film Festival. If you are interested, that's worth checking out. He'll be there April 16th, I believe.
Very good.
In terms of other news, because the Oscars still haven't arrived yet, but hey, there hasn't been a major scandal in the past 24 hours, right? TOG Hackerspace in Dublin 8 in the Black Pits, they're hosting an Oscar night that everybody's invited to come along to. So if you are in Dublin...
I'm invited, am I?
You are, I know. And basically, it's an open evening. They'll be starting the evening about 8 p.m. They're going to have their own mock...
It doesn't start until like 2 a.m.
Well, they're going to have their own mock ceremony for about 2 hours in which their online voting is open now. By the way, you can find links on Scanon or if you just search for the...
We should all go to this.
I'm not sure how to pronounce this. The Oscars. O-I and then Oscars. Let's not try that again.
Let's spell that.
But it is... but they're holding a poll to determine who the Oscar winners should be. And we'll be giving out those awards beforehand.
Is it just picking from the nominations?
I believe it's just picking from the nominations. Sorry, Ethan Hawke.
Okay,
it's also BYOB. As well.
Ooh,
so if you are
I'm totally
on board with that. So I mean, like, last film on your festival screening on Sunday night finishes at
I used to host an Oscar party every year in like 6 a.m. Irish time usually.
Now TOG Hackerspace is hosting it for you, baby.
Where is that?
That is in the Black Pits in Dublin 8.
Excellent. Close to home.
Admission is free, but there is a suggested donation of €5 to keep the penal space open. I think I might
toddle along.
I'm very tempted to go to that. Yeah, I have had tremendous fun over the last few years watching the Oscars live. I did for about 10 years and then didn't the year of the Moonlight thing, and that was a terrible idea of all the ones to miss.
You shut your eyes for one second.
Trudge through 10 years of crap and then miss the best thing.
Fear of missing out. Well, that was the one to beauty, I'm afraid. All right, let's move on to the top 10. At number 10, The Kid Who Would Be King, Joe Cornish's throwback family film.
Yeah, it looks okay. I suppose the whole thing about they don't make them anymore like this is perhaps for a reason. But it looks okay, but it looks a bit.
Well, I mean, the reviews are like, well, this is a nice throwback.
Solid,
that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, don't rush out to see it.
Nostalgia more than
thing. Yeah, I mean, you'll probably like it as much as your kids do because you remember watching this movie when you were
this
a kid.
This is The Goonies.
Which, I mean, then there's nothing wrong with that. Yes, at number 9, The Mule, having earned nearly €500,000 at the Irish box office to date.
Has this come back in or was it there the whole time?
No,
that was not there the whole time. I love.
No, but I don't remember being there last year.
No,
last week
it was, yeah. No, it's been there. It's it's a solid, despite the fact it's called The Mule, it's a solid workhorse.
Oh, yeah. Oakland.
At number 8, A Dog's Way Home.
No. Sorry.
Shame
really? Not sold yet? Really? But what about, like, Ashley Judd?
Isn't it
Edward
animated?
James Alamos? No. No, you're thinking The Queen's Corgi.
Oh, for goodness sake.
It's a litter of dog movies. I mean, okay, fine.
Pause that thought. Sorry.
Oh.
Sorry. I apologize.
Jay, you're
going to
make me barking mad here.
I know.
Sorry, I got a bit of a rough going over there. Ugh. At number 7, it's Happy Death Day to You, which opened on Valentine's Day, and I saw as a double bill with Escape Room.
You are take them for the team, don't you? I really do.
I mean, can you imagine a better way to spend Valentine's
Day? I could
Day
take a several.
Than watching two early, like, February studio horror movies.
Nope.
So Escape Room is basically competent, a remix of all the things that you've already seen in horror movies. There's like, hey, you know that bit where we play an old song but in a creepy way in a trailer? How about we put that in the film?
No.
Oh, what about like a shadowy conglomerate? Oh, yeah, we'll put that in the film. What if there's a conspiracy? Yeah, we'll put that in the film too. Oh, what about a sequence where where it turns out that nothing is what you thought it was? Yeah, we'll do that too. It's basically everything. It's it's basically, PG-13 Saw movie. What are the kids doing these days? Oh, they're doing escape rooms. Can we make them scary?
Are kids doing escape rooms?
I don't know.
But they're doing drugs, surely.
To be fair, there is a charming moment at the end of the film where the whole plan is revealed to the main character.
Naturally.
And, during an exposition from, like, again, a European actor who's been dragged into this mess. But he's like, when he explains the plot, the main character and the audience are presumably quite aghast at, like, the fact that it makes no sense.
Sure.
And the guy who's monologuing is like, yes, I thought it was pretty stupid too. It kind of, I know. So it just kind of goes with it, commits to what it's doing.
I kind of hate this. I'm not going to watch this.
But anyway, Happy Death Day to You, which is a sequel to 2017's Happy Death Day, which was one of, as we talked about this before, one of the surprising, like, early year horror movies. It had the misfortune of coming out around the same time as Get Out, which obviously overshadowed it and is much better, if we're being entirely honest. But Happy Death Day to You was fun. It was Groundhog Day meets Scream, with an incredibly charming protagonist played by Jessica Roth.
Would I like it?
It may be a bit too poppy and self-aware for you, Jay. And with it to the kids. What's interesting, though, about the sequel is while it's not It's not as good as the first one. I'm not even sure it's a particularly good film of itself. But, and there's a big but coming, and I cannot lie, much more experimental, and it's very self-aware. It's a movie that is predicated on the idea that making a sequel to Happy Death Day, in which the main character is slaughtered over and 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 over again, is kind of pointless, because that redundancy is built into the first film. Tree has been through basically her own franchise of horror movies by that point. And the film is like, why would you bother making a sequel to that? There's a moment where, like, their college students are, like, interrupted by the crusty old dean. And he's like, you guys don't understand how it works around here. We need you guys to come up with patents so we can make money to keep the lights on around here. And the students are like, what? You mean this whole thing's about money? And everybody kind of pauses and almost looks at the camera, but don't. And you can tell the film is sort of winking there. But it's kind of, it's a horror sequel that is single-handedly committed to not being a horror movie. It's a very, very strange cocktail. There's a moment, there's a montage in the middle that is built around the central character denying the audience and therefore the killer of the pleasure of killing her for their own entertainment over and over again, which reads as a gigantic screw you to the kind of people who are like, hey, another Happy Death Day movie. It's one of those movies that doesn't really seem to have a reason to exist, but is aware of that and so plays with it. It doesn't earn this. It tries to build a big emotional crux into the story that I'm not sure works, because none of the characters have any personality outside of the lead. But I'm kind of glad that it exists, and it's an interesting way to make a sequel if you have to. And apparently you have to.
And will he make another one?
He has a plan for the third one.
I bet he does.
I have very little patience for that kind of film that acknowledges its own redundance and tries to be self-aware and sly about it. Just, you know, if you know that there's no point for you to exist, maybe don't exist.
There's a moment where the character throws herself out of a plane and gives the finger towards the camera, which apparently she knows exists. Yeah.
See, that kind of thing, you know my patience for that. It's very limited.
At number six, which is actually quite impressive. I'm actually very glad about this, even though I didn't love the film as much as some people have and as much as I loved Moonlight. If Beale Street Can Talk has earned nearly €70,000 at the Irish box office in its first week.
Yeah,
at least 10,000 of that coming from the Valentine's Day previews, which is quite nice.
That's a good idea.
But yeah.
Probably good word of mouth. We might keep it in there a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to seeing this again. I think I've kind of couched my talk about it in this whole idea that it didn't quite live up to expectations, but expectations were enormously high. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Moonlight
and Baldwin. And,
yeah, I mean, very, very much so. Given the word, the extremely positive word that's been floated about on it, a lot of people saying it's their highlight of last year for markets it was released in. That it didn't quite live up to that doesn't mean it's not a good film. I like it a lot. The music is phenomenal. The cinematography, you know,
it's a very appealing movie.
It's very, and I liked it, but not quite as much as I'd hoped I would.
Sadly, yes, not Streets Ahead of Moonlight.
That's exactly where I am with it, that I wish I liked it more. That doesn't mean I don't like it a great deal. I'm looking forward to going back free of the weight of expectations, taking it in a second time, because there are many great things in it.
That's always a trouble when you're talking about movies, where it's like, I liked it a lot, I just didn't like it next to this other, I didn't like it as much as this other thing, which it exists in the shadow of. Speaking of things that I'm sure Jay liked a lot, but exists in the shadow of other things which he likes even more, Robert Rodriguez and James Cameron's Alita: Battle Angel is at number 5.
Yeah.
€300,000 at the box office in Ireland.
I suspect this will nosedive after a week or two once people start hearing.
Well, people are kind of wary about it. I do wonder if it will get the sequel for its weird James Cameron-esque final cameo.
Probably not.
Yeah, it talked about a great deal with Luke on last week's podcast.
James Cameron cameo?
Yeah, the villain is very consciously stylized to look like James Cameron.
Boy. Oh, wow.
Boy. It is not James Gordon.
Because he's a villain.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Like, I mean, no, when the villain first appears, it's on a screen, like a holodeck sort of thing, a hologram, and you only see the guy from a distance. And it's a B-plus list actor, but because he's made up and he has the white hair and the sunglasses on, you don't recognize him. My first thought was, is that James Cameron? anyway, at number 4, it's Green Book.
Film of the year.
Yep, no, Jay's film of the year.
It's okay, despite problems.
Jay's second favorite Oscar contender.
I know,
I'm going to have to say.
Yeah, this has been a bad year for me. I didn't nominate them. They're out there.
Is this the best picture?
That's not the best picture.
Oh, for heaven's
Listeners cannot see that Ronan is pointing towards if Beale Street can talk.
That's exactly it. That's a problem. I wasn't on the favourite, so this is where just everything else is a drop down from Black Klansman.
For me, it's Black Klansman and the favourite are the two great ones. Everything else, whatever.
Favourite, Black Klansman, Vice, Large Gap, Roma, Black Panther, Larger Gap, A Star Is Born, Widest Gap, Vast Chasm, and then the other two.
I've just got Black Klansman, Big Gap, Green Book, Huge Gap, everything else.
All right then. At number three is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. It's actually opening in the US this week.
It's out here for a couple of weeks before.
Yeah, which is pretty nice. Well, I mean, that's just because of kids' schedules and stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, by this stage, I have to reckon all the parents have been dragging to see it.
Is that why we usually get Marvel stuff a week in advance?
We used to do that because of midterms. And so like that, we did the same with Alice in Wonderland with Disney. Like, okay. Disney here position their movies for the midterms. And that's where they make all of the money. At number two, it's Instant Family. Mark Wahlberg and Rose Byrne adopt a bunch of kids because why not? I had a nightmare experience this week where I went to see a surprise film at the Odeon.
No.
I went into the cinema that my ticket was for, having booked it weeks in advance as soon as the event came up.
Yeah.
I took my seat. The commercial played. Then the IFCO certificate was revealed. It was Instant Family. They had moved the surprise screening across the hall. Luckily enough, it was hole in the ground. That's all I have to say about Instant Family.
That happened to me. What film was it last year?
Went to see a dreadful film.
You went to see Darkest Hour.
I wound up seeing Darkest Hour when I think I was there to see 2001 or something.
Yeah. I love that Ronan is so polite that I got up and left Instant Family and walked into Hole in the Wall. Ronan, I like to imagine, would sit through all 2 hours of Instant Family.
Oh, I would watch. I would not watch something again.
But you would watch Darkest Hour.
But it's wall to wall.
I didn't know at the time Darkest Hour was utter trash, and there were 12 people I didn't want to upset by standing up at the very start of a film.
All right.
And I knew at that point I had missed the start of what I had wanted to see.
And at number one, it's The Lego Movie 2, which hasn't performed very well internationally, but so far it's done quite well in Ireland. 300,000 euro, which is pretty great. This weekend. 300,000 euro this weekend for a total of nearly €1 million already, which is great. If you're going to take the kids to a movie, you can take them to something much worse than that.
Don't take kids to worse things. That's cruel.
No, take them to Lego Movie 2. Have a block party.
Take them to the mule.
They can learn important life lessons. Again, my favorite moment of the mule is the moment where Clint Eastwood...
Which threesome?
It's where he leaves the threesome in order to give... life advice to the son of a drug dealer who's like, you know, this life where you get to have threesomes with random women who are old enough to be your granddaughters, you should find something you love and do that instead. It's one of the most surreal beats in a very surreal film. Anyway, opening this week, because we're on a bit of a crunch here, Capernaum, which we talked about a bit earlier.
Indeed, the new Nadine Lamaki.
Really excited.
Can't wait to see it. I've never seen either film, so this is a first.
You should really, really check out Caramel. I think you'd like it a lot. This has gotten great reviews, nominated for Best Picture, Foreign Language Film, Lebanese entry. And has got really good reviews. It's got an incredible child performance at the centre by all accounts, and I'm slightly annoyed that we're in the middle of the festival because I won't be able to see it for a while, but I will squeeze it in as soon as I can.
All right. Also out this week, Cold Pursuit, and we were meant to have Liam Neeson on talking about his hot and sexy new iced revenge thriller.
But, he's busy.
But unfortunately,
they're actually still releasing this. They're not going to try to wait until we've forgotten.
Tragically, the reviews have been really strong. He's really
the reviews have been interesting. Yeah. I mean, like a lot
strong
of them
for
like,
these kind of films. Yeah,
well, I mean, like a Neeson season movie. Yeah. Although I did love The Commuter.
I didn't, but I can see why you did.
I adored The
Commuter. It's weird.
It's amazing.
Much of Neeson is weird now.
Many reasons.
But yeah, Cold Pursuit is a movie in which a father uses the death of his son due to drug addiction to embark on a one-man war on a drug cartel.
So it's like the East of Philippines.
Oh, no, it gets even better. There's a moment apparently where he ties them up in barbed wire. He ties the bodies up in barbed wire and throws them into like a frozen lake. And when he's asked where he learned that, he says, I read it in a crime novel.
Why doesn't he act anymore?
It's applied learning, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a good question.
Also out this week, and I've got no idea what this is, Old Boys.
That is the sequel to Spike Lee's Old Boys.
I like that.
You weren't ready for this.
No, it's the sequel to Spike Lee's. I don't know what that is either.
All right. Total Damal is out, actually, in terms of people who are fans of Indian cinema, which is, I believe, the third installment in the Damal series. Damal meaning fool, I think, in Hindi. I'm not gonna put my neck out in that one.
I slightly suspect that it's a lie. We keep seeing third films in series, having never heard of the other two.
Race 3, baby!
Yeah, Race 3 comes along. You're like, it's the third race film. Like, darn, that's not a series. Stop it.
I like that. We just skipped the first two installments, but they're always rough. But
you're sneaking things in. You're tricking me.
This one stars Anil Kapoor, who is always worth some time. And then finally, probably the big release of the week is On the Basis of Sex, which is the Ruth Bader Ginsburg biography, which is...
directed by Mimi Leader.
Mimi Leader. And it's perfectly fine.
It looks solid in that kind
That's it. It's the old-fashioned sort of movie they don't really make anymore. And the issue is...
Anytime I hear that now, I think they make loads of them.
But again, like, this is a movie that a couple of years, like a decade and a half ago would have been a shoe-in for Best Picture, but is now, like, the market's moved past it. And it's weird because it feels like it's grappling with two outdated forms of biographical picture. The first one is the big holistic life story. Think about films like Gandhi or Patton, for example, where it joins... Bader Ginsburg and her time at university, her husband getting testicular cancer, her attempts to balance the family life and the career that she wants, and having to choose between like going out or trying to go out into the world, not being able to do that and having to work in university instead. And then it does that, pairs that with the second style of biography picture, which has become more common recently, more prevalent, which is the focus intensely on one aspect of a person's life. Think of Frost Nixon with The Interview, for example. Think of Rush with The Race. That's the issue. Yeah. This focuses on the landmark Supreme Court judgment, or sort of Supreme Court case that Bader Ginsburg sort of took around discrimination on the basis of sex.
Yes.
Which is a huge documentary.
I've seen the RBG documentary, which is not brilliant. It's okay. It's well made and well meaning and all the rest of it, but it's a little flat. Yeah. But this, it does go into that in detail in terms of the kind of story. It's interesting in that regard.
And this is fine. The cast are mostly good, generally speaking. Standout is Justin Theroux, who worked with Mimi Leader on The Leftovers, and is very much in the style of quirky 70s supporting character.
I like Leader as a director. I have a lot of time for The Peacemaker and Deep Impact.
Yes.
I think she's a fine
she's
filmmaker.
She's one of the rare sort of blockbuster film directors of the 90s.
I think Peacemaker was the first
DreamWorks film.
It's quite a decent old fashioned
And they both are. I mean, Deep Impact as well is somewhat underrated.
I like it a lot. I think it's really
good. And again, her work on television is also very good. Yeah. Like, we reach a stage where you can't really sort of, there's not really that big a gap.
She does pop up and direct a lot of stuff.
She directed like 10 episodes of The Leftovers.
Yeah,
Leftovers is
as good a TV as there's been the last decade.
Wholeheartedly recommend it. In case anybody on this podcast is waiting for a recommendation for a TV show, I don't know who that could be.
Ronan.
All right, so I think that about wraps it up. But if people look for a bit more Jay, a bit more Ronan in their lives, where can they find you guys?
Wandering around the cinemas in the festival for the next 10 days. But at JCon on Twitter if you want to talk nonsense.
You probably catch me running between Cinema World and the Lighthouse trying to eat something. also on Twitter at Baron Ronan.
You can follow me online at Darren Arscormony. I will also be bouncing around between films. I also co-host another podcast called The 250, where this week we are discussing one of those famous three movies that Ronan just mentioned. Yes, Salman Khan's Race 3. If you've ever wanted to see Salman Khan, who's Bollywood's answer to Sylvester Stallone, fly like a squirrel in slow motion to a hit Bollywood pop tune, we got the movie for you. Is it the Tokyo Drift of the Indian Fast and Furious series? Is it the Fast Five? There's only one way to find out, and that's to listen this weekend. Also, I am, just to announce this, because I've sort of announced this a little bit on other social media, I am doing something very ambitious and very stupid for charity later in the year. For Daffodil Day for the Irish Cancer Society, I am co-hosting an 18-hour podcast discussing Twin Peaks, The Return. David Lynch's 18-hour televisual experience. Let's keep it nebulous. But the idea is...
You are a lunatic and I admire you greatly.
Is it an 18-hour film? Is it an 18-hour TV show? Well, there'll be an 18-hour podcast.
Will Darren be alive after it? These questions will be answered.
But yeah, it's a very good cause. We've got some great guests lined up for it. And if you can support it, please do. It is, like, regardless of how the podcast turns out, it may be terrible. The cause is very worth supporting.
I am
thank you very much
to pop up on that at some point in the time to laugh and enjoy all the Twin Peaks related merriment.
All right, take it easy, guys. We'll be back sometime next week, depending on the festival schedule. Probably a bit more haggard for the experience. Take it easy. Bye.
Bye.